Hi, welcome to Offscript. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're covering what might be the film of the year. Some say it might be the film of the decade. It's One Battle After Another from Paul Thomas Anderson. Very excited to talk about this feature. It's Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, if you haven't heard. We're also going to take a look at, Sorry Baby is the other film we watched for the podcast. We watched this one on streaming. Film came out earlier this year. Black comedy, indie film. It's about a young woman who goes through something incredibly traumatic that kind of stunts her in her life while life just keeps going on and she has to kind of find her way. It sounds much darker than it is. It's actually a first time writing, directing, starring Eva Victor, who put the whole thing together. Excited to talk about it. Stick around for the review. We're going to talk a little bit about Alien Earth. I know we've talked about this a bit on prior episodes, but it just wrapped up. We both watched it. Just kind of wanted to finish out Noah Hawley's season one here. Just going to put a tail on it. Maybe talk a little bit about Peacemaker, Gen V. I know Andy's been watching, so we'll do a little bit of that in TV Corner. Talk about some upcoming trailers. Wicked for Good. We have a new Avatar trailer out. Catherine Bigelow's new movie, House of Dynamite. We have a trailer. Noah Baumbach's new film, Jay Kelly, starring George Clooney. We have a trailer for that. Excited to talk about it. Before we get to everything, a couple quick news stories just to get the podcast going. First things first, we got a new Simpsons movie coming out in 2027. Yeah, the Simpsons movie too, huh? Speaking of television, what do you know about this, Andy?
So in a kind of surprising move, Disney announced that there was going to be a new Simpsons movie in summer 2027, so almost 2 years away. This is a big surprise because there hasn't been a Simpsons movie in like 15 years, and the first one was a big hit. It made $430 million in 2007 or so, but you know, they didn't try to break it into a franchise. They didn't make any more, so it seems a little bit random, and I don't know how well The Simpsons is still kind of relevant culturally. Obviously, it's been going for 37 seasons, but I don't know if who's the audience for this. I went and saw that original, but I'm not really interested in another one. I think the most interesting part of this story is that The Simpsons movie is taking the place of what was a Marvel film. We don't know which one, but that's the slate that they're taking. So I'm more curious about what got kicked down the line.
Sneaky move from Disney Marvel. Anybody out there in listener land know how many seasons of The Simpsons have been on? I'll tell you. This Sunday, they premiered their 37th season of the show. 37 seasons of The Simpsons. I'm going to be honest, it's showing its age, not just culturally, but in its cast. God, I just saw a video earlier today about Marge Simpson's voice actress. It's all the same cast, mostly, I should say. A couple characters have been shuffled around, namely Apu, right? There was some drama regarding him a few years back, but for the most part, still Dan Castellaneta doing Homer, and I can't even remember the name of the woman who plays Marge, but the point is that, like, they're starting to slip, man. Bart does not sound like Bart anymore. Nancy Cartwright plays Bart. Julie Kavner plays Marge. Everybody's starting to sound older, and it feels like the Simpsons writing room maybe has not been able to hang as much in recent years, right? Like, I think a lot of Simpsons fans that I know of, at least, think that the show's twilight years are kind of behind it. Do you think there's any chance that this is maybe a starting to wrap it up? The second movie is kind of like, you know, testing the waters to kind of end the show? Because, like, they can't keep going, right? Like, I think its cultural moment has kind of passed.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, The Simpsons has been through so many eras. It started in the era of broadcast television onto streaming and has survived that and is now owned by Disney ABC. But there's just so many other places to watch TV. I mean, internet, YouTube, TikTok, that sort of thing. But you also have more edgy stuff like South Park or things like that. So The Simpsons is just, it hasn't been culturally relevant for a long time. I think, like, I don't see people post, like, you know, here's some funny stuff from the latest episode. It just doesn't seem to be that relevant. It would be interesting if this was kind of like, well, we're actually shutting down the show and this is going to be kind of how we end it, or the bow tie or something like that. So who knows?
Yeah, like, maybe that would have more appeal. Like, as far as we know, this is just kind of a continuation of what they're doing, and what they're doing just hasn't been very, I don't know, just adding another sauce. It reminds me of, like, the last few seasons of Sunny, like Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Their most recent season of Sunny, really good, actually. Some of their best work they've done in years. But for the past few years, it's been lacking, and fans know it. And it's kind of just this understanding, like, well, you know, show's getting older. Simpsons in 37th season, you know what I mean? Like, and by 2027, we're going to be even further down that line. Like, I don't know. Look, I love Simpsons. There's a hot streak between seasons like 4 and 12 where that show was incredible, but it's fine. We're not a Simpsons show. We're a movie show. But keep an eye out. We'll talk more about the movie as it comes up. Definitely cover the trailer when that inevitably comes down the line. I'll talk about James Mangold real minute. Yeah, James Mangold for a minute. James Mangold, right? The guy who directed Ford v. Ferrari and the Bike Riders.
Logan.
Logan. Logan. He is signing an exclusive deal to be with Paramount. Right, Paramount Skydance, they just had this big merger. It looks like they're locking down talent, and James Mangold is one of these, just like Universal is locking up directors. Warner Brothers has some exciting deals going with a lot of their people. Paramount wants James Mangold in the tent, especially for his next high-profile feature. It's going to be starring a very young movie star, big up-and-comer. What do you know about this, Andy?
Well, one of the things that studios have been doing in the last few years is trying to kind of nab directors. Christopher Nolan famously went from Warner Brothers over to Universal after he wasn't real happy with them doing simultaneous releases on streaming and theaters during the pandemic. We know that Universal has also scooped up other directors. And so it's just kind of something that Hollywood's trying to get on. They're trying to identify big bankable talent and say, come with us. We'll give you the budget. We'll give you final cut and last say, and just please earn us $1 billion. And so James Mangold is starting to get in on that deal as well.
Yeah. It's a little weird. He'd been talking about doing some other projects at other places. Namely, he was talking about doing a Star Wars movie for Disney called Dawn of the Jedi. That was a while back, though. He also was reportedly working on a horror feature for DC Studios centered on the Swamp Thing. Right, James Mangold's Swamp Thing we talked about a little bit, and I guess that's probably not happening, at least not with James Mangold in tow. It seems like he's going to be locked up with Paramount here for a minute. No specifics on money, no specific on number of features, but one thing's for sure, James Mangold's going to be at Paramount for a while. And if you want to watch James Mangold's next few features, you're going to be doing it on Paramount Plus or Skydance Plus, whatever it's called. Also, quick correction, I said he directed Bike Riders. He didn't. Jeff Nichols directed the Bike Riders. James Mangold directed A Complete Unknown, which we covered on this show, right? The Bob Dylan biopic. So if you want to see that and what we said about it, hit the YouTube channel. I don't know. Scroll back a minute. You'll find it. It's not too far. I promise. We covered it not that long ago. Fine watch. But that's James Mangold. One more story from the box office this week. One battle after another, maybe not doing as well as Warner had hoped, but God, Warner's had a great year this year, so I don't think they're worried about it. What do the numbers look like?
So One Battle After Another did win the weekend, but it's box office-wise, it's a steep uphill climb. It was a very expensive movie, but it was kind of one of these arts for our art's sake. Made $22 million over the weekend, $48 million. Globally, it's something like $104 to $150 million. So, like, it's probably not gonna make its money back, but that's not kind of the point of this movie. But and Warner Brothers has been doing great with all year with the rest of their releases. Second came a newcomer, Gabby's Dollhouse, the movie, which is a film based on a Netflix series that's been out since 2021, made $13 million over the domestic weekend, $19 million globally. I don't know anything about that. I was like, what is this movie? I had to go look it up. Kids movie that apparently very popular. In at number three is Demon Slayer Infinity Castle at $605 million globally. I mean, just huge numbers. $7.1 million over the weekend, $118 million domestic. Yeah, that's more than Superman has made. That's a stat I saw somewhere that it surpassed Superman, and it's all, and it hasn't been out. I guess it's actually been out about the same amount because it came out in Japan first several weeks ago. The Conjuring Last Rites came in fourth with $6.8 million, $161 million domestic, $435 million globally. Huge. This is actually the biggest movie in that franchise, which is crazy because I thought they were kind of winding things down. I thought that the steam was kind of out and huge, and we're gonna be getting a lot more from that franchise, not dead. And then right out the top five was The Strangers Chapter 2 with $5.9 million domestic and $7.2 million globally. Not great, but it's a small cheap horror film, not positive reviewed, but it did land in the top five.
You know, I think it really shows just how kind of experimental theaters are willing to be right now. The success of Demon Slayer is one thing. Gabby's Dollhouse, the movie, which is not something Andy and I have any idea about, and we've been doing a movie podcast for a long time. That comes in at number two this weekend. Both of us were like, what is that? I've never even heard of that. It's got multiple seasons on Netflix. Like, that's an adaptation from over there. Additionally, like, One Battle After Another, 20% of its ticket sales came from premium formats. 70mm, VistaVision, IMAX. Not a lot of VistaVision because there's only three of those theaters in the United States, I think. But for everybody else, like 20%, one out of every five tickets was sold in a premium theater, right? So premium screenings, nostalgia screenings, foreign film, anime, like kids stuff coming over from streaming services. Like, theaters are willing to run in any direction to find audiences to come in right now. And like, it's just a lot different than maybe a decade ago when it was like, the weekend would be much more traditional, right? Like, you just see, okay, here's the few movies I know of, and that's what's in theaters, and that's what's running. Not so. Like, we're in a different place at the movies, and I think it's cool to see how culture has proliferated throughout the theater, if that makes sense.
Yeah, horror continues to be something that we can count on with both The Conjuring: Last Rites and The Strangers Chapter 2 rounding out the top five. Again, anime is a huge thing with the youth. This Demon Slayer movie, which is I read that it's based on like an arc from 2016 or so. So it's from a while back, but it's been a wildly popular show and manga. Don't know anything about Gabby's Dollhouse, and I think this is the biggest opening for Paul Thomas Anderson as well, yeah. Or maybe his second. It's doing really well for him as a director.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's a better segue that we're going to get to talk about One Battle After Another than that, right? First of the weekend, biggest weekend ever for him. Let's talk about One Battle After Another. I'm going to be taking the summary for it, so please excuse any odd delivery. No spoilers here, by the way. We're not a spoiler cast, so we're not going to spoil anything for you. You can listen to this and know that you're going to be fine going in. We're not ruining anything. Let's get into it. The movie is One Battle After Another. So One Battle After Another is the story of a revolutionary. Bob is his name, a man who is kind of a stoner and kind of hiding out from the law and the world around him following some events that happened at the beginning of the film. Bob has a relationship with Perfidia, this wonderful firecracker, lightning bolt of a woman who is kind of leading the charge with the French 75, their revolutionary group, who are attacking ICE encampments and banks and courthouses, right? All in the name of global change, right? That we are going to embrace acts of violence upon, you know, institutions, not people per se, and, you know, go in and steal money and make a name for ourselves and make noise and say that things got to change. Well, the military is aware of this, led by Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, played by Sean Penn. He is hot on their tail. And following some events in the first kind of 40 minutes of the movie, we get a time jump to 16 years into the present day when Bob is raising his daughter, Willa. And Willa is effectively kidnapped by these forces, kind of led by Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw. And this becomes a kidnapping feature. I got to go out and I got to find my daughter and get her back, right? But you don't want to look at a movie like Taken. You want to look at something like, I don't know, The Big Lebowski or like Terminator 2. People have compared this to Star Wars, The Searchers. Very thematically dense, as is to be expected from Paul Thomas Anderson. It is nearly 3 hours long, shot in VistaVision, incredible score from Johnny Greenwood, and fantastic performances all around from Leonardo DiCaprio, Tiana Taylor, Chase Infinity, newcomer. We previously saw her in the series Presumed Innocent, which she's pretty solid in. God, Sean Penn is stunning in this movie. Regina Hall's in this movie. Really just fantastic. And people are talking about this being the film of the year, right? An Oscar contender in many categories, possibly the film of the decade. Big shoes to fill for One Battle After Another. So I'm looking forward to talking about it. Andy, what did you think of One Battle After Another?
So there had been quite a bit of hype after the first few viewing, like people were able to see it. And like Zach said, it was film of the year, film of the decade, 10 out of 10, 20 out of 10 kind of thing. And when we got into the film and we got to see it in the 70mm IMAX, I got about 15 minutes in and I thought, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen, or this is going to be the greatest movie I've ever seen. And not to overhype it, but it reminded me of, like, you know, if you've ever gone to a movie that turns out to be a classic, like what was it like in 1990 or 1989 when people went and saw things like Goodfellas or Titanic? More recently, I think something like Parasite is something that was like a big cultural phenomenon and a movie that was kind of took everyone by storm. This is that movie for the 2020s. And it's just incredible on so many levels. The score, the story, thematically, it's very strong. And it's somewhat of a simple story. It's about a group of revolutionaries 15, 20 years after they were really that. And they're kind of what happens when the past catches up to you and how revolutions are handed off from generation to generation, but how they change. And I mean, it's thematically so rich. The pace is incredible because this is 2 hours, 40 minutes, and it just goes. It's like Mad Max Fury Road. It just has its foot on the gas the entire time. Like, it never feels slow. I mean, there's just so much in here, and it might actually be living up to the hype that everyone has said that it is.
Yeah, it might be. It is transportive in nature. Like, you just forget about your problems outside of the theater 20 minutes into it, right? It's so kinetic, and its action is constant. It just keeps moving. We just keep barreling forward. There's a great line early in the movie when they're just about to set off, like, one of their first big kind of, not heists per se, but displays of freeing a bunch of people when DiCaprio says, like, from here on out, it's one battle after another. And it's just, like, constant. It just keeps coming at you. It's very different from Paul Thomas Anderson's work. This is his 10th feature film. Most of his stuff is very heady. It's very people talking in rooms. It's very chill and quiet. He is not often getting real high energy and real kinetic like this. I know there was some stuff like that in Boogie Nights. So this is a big departure for him. And this is him doing a lot of new stuff he doesn't do. And a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson stands out there have been saying this is, like, they didn't know he could do this. You know, they didn't know he could shoot a feature like this. They didn't know he could shoot a car chase like he shoots a car chase. Not just at the beginning, which is all these hills that you've probably seen imagery from, but, like, dude, even in the open, there's like there's a bunch of car accidents that happen around this bank heist thing that are really violent and really brutal on VistaVision cameras, for God's sake, that are huge and old and bulky and are not meant to move like they move in this feature. Like, it's a level of detail and, like, action orient that I think just gives it such a vibe and is so exciting to watch and be a part of. It's very funny. It's a very funny script.
Yes. Yeah.
Not in its first act as much. That first act is really dedicated to, like, setting the stakes and the tone and getting into these, like, deeply troubling thematic elements, the military engagement, cycles of violence, people who crave actual change versus just like war and engagement. Outside of that, like, once you get through that stuff, like, man, DiCaprio is firing on all cylinders. He is so great in this movie. Everybody's really funny in it.
I wanted to get into our plot a little bit. We do have fantastic performances all around. Like, it's like, who do you nominate for awards? Because everyone is so good. But we start with the French 75, who are, as we said, a group of radicals, and they are, like, they do things like they free a detention center, they are setting things on fire, they are blowing stuff up in that kind of very traditional way that we think of kind of a radical revolutionary would be. But it all sort of goes wrong. The first act is largely prologue. It's set up, and our group is largely disbanded. People are caught, captured, killed. Bob is one of the few to get away and starts just living the quiet life and raising his daughter now, Willa, played by the newcomer Chase Infinity. And that's kind of our setup. And then something happens, and all of a sudden the U.S. government becomes interested in these old revolutionaries and starts going after them. And it's this wild, wild chase the rest of the film. Chase Infinity is... there's people after her, there's people after Bob, they are trying to reunite, and then it's just pedal to the metal after that. They're both on the run, there's big scenes of action and protest. There's about a 30-minute scene in the middle where lots of people are running, trying to get away and hide from other people. It's absolutely incredible. Meanwhile, we also have Sean Penn, who's Stephen Lockjaw, he's a Terminator-esque figure who's just this ruthless, playing well outside the law military guy that are going after these people and abusing their position and their resources as part of the government to hunt down these people for personal and non-personal reasons. He is an incredible Sean Penn. He is transformed in this, and it's not like he like gained a bunch of weight or lost a bunch of weight. He just, everything about him is just a new person. The way he looks, the way he walks, particularly his face. He's the weirdest guy, and he's just like won't stop, but is also deeply pathetic and vulnerable. So it's that's our most of our, I don't want to talk more about our plot, but that's where we start and where we get going.
Yeah, Penn is tremendous. It is easily, I think, getting an Oscar nom. He's probably winning the Oscar this year. Like, I haven't seen every performance, obviously, but like, he is so tremendous in this movie. It's his best performance in a decade, I think. Opposite him, Tiana Taylor is doing really great work in this movie. Yeah, she is this absolute firebrand of a revolutionary who's like just the kind of the motor for much of Leonardo DiCaprio's actions in the first chunk of the film. Same with Lockjaw. Like, they're kind of operating orbitally around her. She is a really big part of what's going on in here. You can see her a bit in the trailer. It's nice because a lot of this movie isn't in the trailer, and a lot of it we're not talking about here intentionally. I do want to mention, speaking of things I'm not talking about, Benicio del Toro's Sensei Sergio is his name. Tremendous. I already thought he put out one of his best performances this year in Phoenician Scheme, the Wes Anderson feature. He's doing it again here. He's tremendous and funny and nuanced and like doing these great delivery things. It's weird because so much of this movie wasn't on the page. That was something doing research for this. I was really surprised to hear. Paul Thomas Anderson's been working on this film for a couple decades. He's kind of had these ideas dancing around his head. A lot of it comes from Thomas Pynchon's Vineland, which is an older book about revolutionaries in the 60s who are now in the 80s and feeling out of date and out of touch. Kind of fitting for what we're looking at here in a modern setting. Also, a lot of it, I think, comes from his personal experience. Paul Thomas Anderson is a father. He's a father of biracial children, as Bob is in this movie. So, like, that's a little bit addressed. There's some stuff in there about that. What's interesting is that even though he had so much time to work on it, like a lot of this, they ended up still putting in after the fact. Benicio del Toro brought a lot of his ideas to Sensei Sergei and like Sergio and turned him into what he is. This whole big car chase sequence that you've seen these hills from that comes in towards the end of the movie. A lot of that they found during location scouting. Location scouting, by the way, excellent. Most of it's in California and we're in Texas, and I figured a lot of it was taking place in Dusty, Texas, but fortunately those landscapes look similar. Like a lot of practical shooting. There's this one riot sequence in this like small town after Lockjaw has kind of rolled in with the military and just told everybody like, yep, we're here to apprehend some perps because drugs and narcotics and illegal. So the military just goes along with it. He can just direct them to do whatever he wants. And, God, like you got Leo running across rooftops at night trying to keep up with skaters while there's riots happening, like flaming things in the street. And it's like, how did you even shoot this? Like, it just feels transportive. It feels like you're taken to a place that is so different.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. How it's filmed, these incredible action sequences. So this is why the movie is so expensive, and it's absolutely worth it because you have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of extras, lots of location. This movie is largely, you don't know this from the trailer, but it really features three black women. Leo is a main character, but he's not really the main part of the story. He's the one trying to get his daughter back, but it's more about Tiana Taylor, Willa played by Chase Infinity, and Regina Hall as well. She's part of the French 75. It's so funny because I always think of Regina Hall from her Scary Movie days, and like she becomes such an incredible actor. Chase Infinity is also a gem, a newcomer. This is her first major, I think this is her first film at all. They searched for years because they needed a biracial woman who was a certain age and also knew martial arts, because that comes into play in this. And there's not a lot of talking. She doesn't have to talk a lot, but she has to do a lot of action, a lot of acting. There's a lot of rough and tumble stuff. She's handcuffed through a lot of it. She's going to be an absolute star, but like the cast is really incredible. That's one of the best things. And it's, everyone has great lines. Everyone's been quoting this film. It just came out over the weekend. Like, I can just go on and on. It's hard to, but you don't want to. I don't want to spoil anything.
I know. We got to start to curb it too. We don't keep these reviews that long. But no, I want to talk about quickly the duality of the two forces, right? We have our revolutionaries who are kind of embraced by or presented by through like Bob, right? Our kind of like old burnout revolutionary who's kind of out of the game, but still obviously like needs to rely on the resources available to him. And then we've got Colonel Stephen Lockjaw, who kind of represents the military and the might of the government, right? Like whether that be right or wrong, he is to say he's the one who tells people where to go and they just do it. No questions asked, right? It's a great scene where he tells the lieutenant or something. He's like, make up an excuse for me to invade this small town or something. And he's like, yep, you got it. Find me a reason kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, we're just going to go do what I want because that's the deal. He's awful and terrible. But both of these, like, men are trying to get to this one person, Willa. It's this kind of triangle movie where they're, like, trying to use the resources available to get there. And it's all about just, I don't know, having to deal with one thing after another and how these generational problems, you know, may not be trapped within each generation, that maybe the next one will grow and be better and be smarter, right? Like, we don't always have to keep doing these cycles of peoplehood. Incredible score, Johnny Greenwood. I don't want to say too much more about it. We saw it, like you said, on 70mm IMAX. Incredible presentation if you have the means. Any other thoughts or recommendations, yeah, Andy?
I wanted to say a sister film to this that a lot of people have been talking about is Eddington. From just a couple of months ago, because they're very similar in that they're very recent and they're about kind of current political happenings and political climate, but they're very different. I think one of the best posts I saw about it is that Eddington is about politics and One Battle After Another is political. So it's very different things. And there were some politicians who were kind of condemning the film for encouraging like radical violence. And that's not what's happening here. And I think it's very clear that people understand that is our revolutionaries are very violent at the beginning of the film. It doesn't accomplish much. And like I said, they are nearly all killed or captured. And that's kind of the point, is that maybe like that's how things were at one time. That kind of revolution was kind of effective. It's not so much anymore. And partially because you're not going to outgun the government. You can't outrun them. You have to find a different way. And we see that kind of demonstrated in the film, but there's so much in this. Like we could talk forever about different themes, about generations and politics and change and violent governmental violence. I mean, we can just go on forever, but we won't. Fantastic score, one of the best scores. I got 15 minutes in and I was like, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah. Andy, would you recommend One Battle After Another?
Absolutely. Run, don't walk to your nearest cinema. See it on the biggest screen you can. We were fortunate enough to see it on 70mm IMAX. Just incredible filmmaking, really fast paced for its long run time. Funny, incredible performances, profound in what it's trying to say, the many things it's trying to say. Highly, highly recommend. Go out and see it.
Yeah, same. One Battle After Another rocks. Big radical ideas in here. It'll scare the straights. You'll love it. Go see it on a big screen as soon as possible. It will not play the same at home. That being said, I cannot wait to get the 4K of this thing. Awesome. Very dusty movie. Very dusty Paul Thomas Anderson. That's the other thing. It's like Eddington, right? It's all desert and southern. Anyway, we got to move on. We got other stuff to talk about on this episode, besides what's probably the best movie of the year. We got to talk about some upcoming trailers. What do we call this segment, Andy?
It's time for the trailer park. So we got the full trailer of Wicked Part 2, better known as Wicked for Good, which comes out around Thanksgiving. It was obviously Wicked the First was very huge success last year. We get to see more of Glinda and Elphaba. They're kind of in their positions. This is different from the novel, which I've read most of. I haven't quite finished it. So there's lots of changes, but we see our characters maturing in their respective positions. There's a lot going on in this, and it's a 3-minute trailer, so I'm not going to try and describe it too much. We also see tie-ins from The Wizard of Oz, which I hear has been altered somewhat from the musical because the book and stuff takes place in Oz, but not necessarily involving The Wizard of Oz, which they're tying in more. This looks really good. Wicked fans are going to be eating good come November. I'm going to see it. This turned me into a Wicked fan after I had not been for 20 odd years. So I'm excited for this. It's going to make a ton of money.
I'm definitely excited for it. Yeah, Jonathan Cho shot this right alongside the first one. So as far as production goes, like, these things are hand in hand. They did not wait 2 years or anything. Like, and it's funny because I had not seen the musical, and I'm familiar with, like, the original film, but I'm not a big Oz stan or anything. I don't know a lot about him. I haven't seen the musical. But after that first movie ended, I remember thinking I would stick around and watch another hour of this. Like, much like the intermission in the play, like, after you hit the end of part one, you're like, I can't wait to see part two. So after a year, I think that buzz is still good, for sure. What's been surprising to me is kind of low-key, like, spoilers on the internet. I don't know if you've seen this, Andy, but, like, I have not seen the musical. I've not read the book. A lot of people on Twitter were saying, well, like, well, the musical's been out for 22 years, so if you didn't know, yeah, okay, dog. Like, you still don't got to tell me exactly what happens at the end of the second movie. You know what I mean? I wouldn't mind being a little surprised, but their social media team has been very sharing a lot about characters and, oh, here's this character in this costume that they're going to be in. Yeah, and you're like, oh god, like, I didn't know that was the way it was going. So, like, as far as the film side goes, little surprised, but still looking forward to it. It's probably going to be a banger. Very emotional. Can't wait to watch Ariana Grande cry again on screen. She's going to be fantastic. Yeah, it's going to be a good time. We got to talk about the second trailer for Avatar Fire and Ash. This dropped not too long ago. We got a teaser that we had covered on the show, which looked pretty exciting. This is kind of a more expanded version of that, as second trailers often are. A little bit more plot. Essentially, what we have is following the events of the Sully family, right? Our Avatar friends, our Navi friends. That's what I'm looking for. The Sully family is doing fine after the events of Avatar 2. The Way of Water. They're still hanging out with their water tribe, but now they got to go find more people, right? More Na'vi to rally against the human folk. Unfortunately, the human folk managed to get to the fire tribe first, it seems, and convince them that, hey, you got to help us fight those water Na'vi. They're no good. So it's a bit of a civil war between Na'vi going on, fueled by, God, I cannot remember the name of the bad guy in this. It's not Lockjaw, but it's a very similar character to Sean Penn. Yeah, Quaritch, right. Yeah, very similar to Sean Penn's Lockjaw. Maybe not quite as funny from one battle after another. Yeah, that's what we got. We got parents stressing. We see big whales coming out of water, right? There's a Sigourney Weaver's teenager character. Oh, and that spider, right? The male, one human guy who wants Jack to be Champion. Navi. He's got a tail now. He's getting turned into, like, part Navi or something. And so that's interesting. They got a shot of him, like, with these spores growing up his face and into his lungs. And that lets him breathe the high nitrogen air so he doesn't have to be a Navi, I guess. Like, I don't know. But blending the themes of horror, it's fine. I got to stop talking about Avatar Fire and Ash. Andy, what do you think of the trailer?
If one battle after another is the movie of the year, Avatar Fire and Ash is, like, the visual spectacle of the year. This looks amazing, and I have famously not been a big Avatar fan for the last two films, but I am excited about this. It looks great. I'm excited about these fire Na'vi that are not about Aowa and nature and all this, and they feel betrayed by all that. They were like, where was Aowa when our village burned and the volcano erupted? It just visually looks stunning. It looks so good. It's probably going to be the most successful film of the year. It looks great.
Yeah, it looks like a really good time. That's coming out December, right? This December?
Yeah, Christmas time. Next, we have a House of Dynamite, which we got the full trailer for. This is the new entry from Kathryn Bigelow. It's a military thriller starring Rebecca Ferguson, Greta Lee, the great Willa Fitzgerald from Strange Darling, and more. And this deals with they're all military people, and a nuclear weapon is fired at the United States, and no one knows where it's from. It's not attributed to any country, and it's like, it's the real deal. They have minutes to respond. So it's about, like, what would that kind of response look like if there was some sort of preemptive nuclear attack? How do you respond to that? Which you don't have a lot of time. You have, like, 10 minutes to make decisions. So it's that kind of political military thriller. Looks really good. I'm excited to see it. And that comes out on October 24th. So a little bit later this month.
Yeah, that'll be on Netflix. I don't know if it's getting a theatrical release. I hope so. Like, I'd love to catch it if it's in theaters.
It's getting
for
a like
week
a 2 week thing.
Yeah, Netflix will just long enough for award season, right? And then we'll be right back to it. Like they did with Fincher's The Killer or Rian Johnson's Glass Onion. Yeah, it'll briefly be out. Yeah, this is exciting. I think a lot of people don't like. Most people in the culture are not aware of Kathryn Bigelow, I think, and they should be because she's made some pretty incredible features. You could say Hurt Locker, sure, Zero Dark Thirty, Point Break in like 91, right? A movie that if you've ever seen Hot Fuzz, you know what Point Break is, and a lot of people saw that movie because that directly inspired that. Like the work of Kathryn Bigelow is prescient, especially considering, God, I just finished talking about Avatar, which was her ex-husband, James Cameron. He's making those. They were married for a minute, right? It's exciting, and this looks like a bit of a boiler pot kind of movie, right? Like things are going to boil over, big tense, military-industrial complex. She does a lot of good work over there. I saw an early review that was cynical on it, and that bums me out. And I hope that that was just some junk or maybe not even real because this looks exciting, and like I go for stuff like this. A lot of people talk in rooms. Tracy Letts is in this movie. So yeah, House of Dynamite. Keep it here on Offscript. We'll talk about a little bit more when it comes out. One more to talk about. In December 5th, we're getting Jay Kelly, which is the new Noah Baumbach feature, right? Yeah, Noah Baumbach, that guy that helped write Barbie and then made that movie White Noise for Netflix starring Adam Driver that nobody saw. Yeah, well, he's got a new movie coming out called Jay Kelly starring George Clooney as our lead, Jay Kelly. Adam Sandler is what appears to be his agent. Jay is a very successful Hollywood star. You want to think like a Clark Gable, Gene Kelly, Jay Kelly, kind of character, right? An older star in modern day who's looking back on his career and his life and is like, maybe I don't quite have it all. I'm not emotionally fulfilled for some reason. So he leaves his daughter at home, takes his agent, Adam Sandler. They go to Italy for some sort of trip where they're going to meet a lot of people who obviously recognize Jay Kelly, a household name. Everyone knows who worldwide star Jay Kelly is, and maybe discover something a little bit about themselves. Perhaps Jay will see inward and discover something new about how movies are moments in time and memories to him, but stories to others. You know, it's Hollywood writing about itself kind of movie, and how appropriate for Baumbach, who's been in this industry his whole life. What do you know about Jay Kelly?
This looks kind of fine. I can't quite place the tone. I was like, this is either going to be a masterpiece or it's going to be a big miss. Like, I can't really, it seems to be a little bit of a dramedy. Jay Kelly is kind of, it seems like he's missed out on his family. He's missed out on his daughter grow up. He's kind of estranged from them, but he's got all this love from all these adoring fans. Laura Dern is also in this. It looks fine. This is a straight to Netflix thing, out on December 5th. I just have a kind of a hard time getting a feel for it. Adam Sandler is also in it as well, so it's going to have some laughs as well.
Yeah, Jay Kelly looks all right. I like I said, I'm a little lukewarm on Noah Baumbach. I really like Marriage Story. When we covered that on the show, that movie rocks. Like, but yeah, like I know White Noise didn't do all that good. I don't know. We'll see. It seems like a good Hollywood pat itself in the back kind of movie. You know what I mean? And like a movie about movie makers. And like for us film heads out there, it's probably a great time. For everybody else, I don't know. Speaking of film, we got to stop talking about movies. We got to start talking about television. Quick TV corner look. I know we don't have any formal bumper for this or anything. But Andy, we just finished watching Alien Earth. For folks out there who maybe missed our last couple episodes talking about it, quick run-up on the season. Let people know, good or bad. What do you think?
I think the season's been real up and down. Season finale was last week. There were some, it was mixed. There were some high highs. Some people were disappointed. Some people loved it. I was a little disappointed with it just because I wanted things that were teased along the season to kind of wrap up a little bit more. And the finale very much did mostly just tease the next season. It was doing a lot of setup for the second. And it felt like it was missing an episode. Like in Game of Thrones season one is a good example where episode 9, like the second to last episode, is actually the climax of the season. It's when Honorable Ned gets his head cut off. Spoilers. And then you get one more episode, which is tying up some loose ends. It's epilogue and it's set up for the next season. So we kind of didn't get a big climax. We did get some payoffs, but there's a lot of things that were like, oh, this thing that we were setting up, stick around and you might see more in season two. So that was a little disappointing. I think overall the season has been, it's been up and down. Episode five, the Maginot episode where we find out what happened, the one that's an alien movie essentially, is really good. The show, I think, starts really well. A little weak in episodes 3 and 4 and 6 and 7. 8 is mixed depending on who you ask. I'll definitely watch more, but I was hoping to get a little bit more of a conclusion. Season 2 has not been renewed also.
I think Alien has such a funny relation, or Alien Earth, I should say, it's such a funny relationship with suspense. That's, I think, part of the problem. Like, because Alien as an idea, as a concept, essentially, like, suspense is one of the many languages with which these stories are told, right? Like, there's a creature on board and we don't know where it is. We don't know how dangerous it is. We don't know how it works. We have to figure it out. Oh my God, there it is. It looks like a thing and it's not. Oh my, it could be anywhere. You know, like, a lot of that is what's so frightening about Alien, right? And is that as the series has grown and changed, that element of like suspenseful storytelling has been moved around a bit, right? Ridley Scott definitely played with it a lot in Prometheus and Alien Covenant. Like, those movies pull back and are a little bit more like scientific and lofty and aspirational in these theories of like God and man, right? And Alien Earth has a lot to work on in that way, because we all know what an alien looks like. So before the show ever started, I remember talking about it on this show and talking about how are you going to do it? You can't hide the alien for 8 episodes and then be like, ah, alien at the end. We all know what an alien is. And Alien Earth is smart about this, because in its very first episode, within minutes, you get a full on look at a xenomorph. They got one like in full lighting in a hallway. You can see it. It's very much like an acknowledgement between creators and audience that you guys know what an alien looks like and we know what an alien looks like, and we're all on that page. And by establishing that link and giving us really familiar elements in the first few episodes, Alien Earth sets such a great base to tell a story, such a great foundation with these the Lost Boys, the Peter Pan stuff is clever. Like, that stuff all works really good. Reminds me of like Star Wars Force Awakens, right? Lots of questions, lots of room to roam. But much like that, much like Force Awakens, like, it has to get somewhere by the end. And that sense of suspense that you create through additional monsters and other creatures, like this eyeball thing that's in there, and exciting characters like Boy Cavalier and Kirsch, played by Timothy Oliphant, who's great. I think it has trouble bringing us up with that and keeping us in suspense all the way through. Episode 5 is a great standout, right? It's like a flashback episode. That one all works good. But the thing I think the cardinal sin it commits for me, the thing that I don't like about it, is cliffhangers. Like, it'll end an episode on something that seems like it's going to be so big and so revelatory. Or there'll be a scene with one of these synthetic characters who's like starting to lose their mind, and it seems like it's going to be the biggest deal ever. And then just kind of isn't. You get to next week and it's like, oh yeah, that wasn't really that big of a deal. We kind of overhyped it. And this sense of like overhyping events that aren't actually coming through, alongside like trying to create new suspense in areas where you don't have it previously, like, I think it leads to a season starting really strong and starting to feel like it fizzles out towards the end. Like, we're running out of road, you know? So cutting it at 8 is smart. And I've talked too much about this. What do you think, Andy?
I think there's too much going on in the show in general. There's too many characters, frankly, because you have all the hybrids, which are like 6 people. You have Prodigy, Team Prodigy, which is like Boy Cavalier, his sidekick, Curse, Timothy Oliphant's character. You have the Weyland-Yutani representation by a young Miss Yutani. Also the great and new Babu Cisse as Mauro, which is one of, he's a cyborg character working for Yutani, trying to get these alien and other creatures back. He's probably the best character on the show. So we have some good characters, but there's just almost too many of them. And we're going to be talking about Peacemaker here in a second. One thing I think that show does really well is it keeps it focused. There's basically there's a major plot line and a minor plot line, and that's pretty much it. And then we have combinations of characters, but there's still just 2 things going on. There's like 8 things going on in Alien Earth, and it's really too much, and I think it just needs to be more focused for season 2.
Yeah, I don't want to give away any spoilers or anything. It's not what we do on this show. But for what it's worth, I have enjoyed watching it, and I'm looking forward to watching more. I'm going to have to resub to Hulu next year when I do, because I killed my subscription immediately after finishing the last episode. But even still, for 8 episodes, solid. I'd love to, I hope they release it physical. I'd love to like get a Blu-ray. I can give it to my pops for Christmas because he's a big fan and shouldn't have to be stuck on a platform to watch this thing. Like, I think it's solid. I really do. Like in the alien pantheon of the alien things that have been made, Alien Earth is a confident television project that I think works good and is solid. And I'm looking forward to making more. But yeah, feedback on season one, just like two or three too many plot lines. Tighten it up. Also, give me more Kirsch. More Timothy Oliphant, please. More. He was not so in the show enough. He's so great. Also, Moro. Dude, that guy should get an Emmy. He probably won't because the Emmys are going to be stacked. But he's so good in this show. Like, multiple Emmy awards should be considered for Alien Earth. It's really great. We should talk about Peacemaker. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah,
closing thoughts on Alien Earth. I don't want to cut you off.
Other than the series was up and down, some high highs, some good characters, too many characters, too many plot lines. Season two has not been officially renewed yet. It probably will be, but I mean, if it doesn't, then it seems like a real bad way to end the season. So we'll see in a couple of years when we get season two.
Yeah. As for Peacemaker, still a couple episodes left. I think we're both caught up on it, right?
Yes, we're six episodes in. I don't want to talk too much about plot other than we have this dimensional portal where Christopher Smith, a Peacemaker, has found a parallel universe where things are great and totally different, and he wants to be there, and he basically decides, I'm going to live in New Earth because old Earth sucks, and I don't want to be there. And meanwhile, we have General Rick Flag, which we saw in the Superman movie, who is after him, and he's like, he killed my son, that we saw in the events of the Suicide Squad. I'm going after him and sending my team after him. Those are our main two plots. And again, that it's so simple, but I love this show. I'm like, clear my schedule. Nothing gets in the way. 8 p.m. Thursday is Peacemaker. And it's so funny, and it's got great music and so much charm, and also a lot of heart. I mean, people are talking about always like tearing up the end of the episode. I'm loving it, and I can't wait. Two more episodes, and apparently it's supposed to lead up to Man of Tomorrow, which is the Superman follow-up, so we'll see in these next two episodes.
Yeah, I've really been impressed by the like larger implications of Peacemaker. Season one obviously like fits in the DC universe, but it's kind of loose, and it's kind of in its own space. Season two has direct like engagements with Creature Commandos, which is nuts, like I didn't expect, and notably some Superman engagements, which are really cool. Like I know Gunn had wanted to rush getting Superman out into homes so that people could see it before watching Peacemaker, which was weird because you're like, well, how's Superman going to affect Peacemaker? But it does a little bit. And as the season has gone on, it's been more affecting. And it's really cool to see those two things like interact. Like I can't get more Superman, but Peacemaker's just kind of scratching that itch a little, which is really nice. It's very funny. And I just like how like, I don't know, lo-fi it feels. Like Superman feels so pronounced. Everything's on a tripod. Everything's very cinematic and big. A lot of Peacemaker shot handheld. Like it's a lot of on-the-go stuff, and it just gives it a, like, much like Creature Commandos, which is animated, but it gives it a very different feeling, and it's very much its own identity. Like cinematically, it looks like its own thing. It feels like its own thing. A Peacemaker movie would feel nothing like a Superman movie. Like they are very different, you know? And I think that's intentional. I think it's good. I think Peacemaker is a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it, and I'm enjoying it more as the season goes on. Much like season one, I remember feeling like season one, I was like, this doesn't feel that concentrated. I don't really know where it's going, and the theme song is a little weird. And by the end of season one, I was like turning it up as loud as I could when the intro started, and I was like, I can't wait to watch the finale here. And like that's where I'm at with season two. I was like, all right, new theme song. Don't really know where it's headed. We'll see. And every week over week, I'm like, God, this thing rips. And I cannot wait to watch more. Like, you just get more into it as it keeps going. Creature Commandos is the same damn effect. Like, James Gunn knows what he's doing. Confidence in James Gunn, I think. And Peacemaker is a big start of that.
Yeah, I'm really loving it. Really enjoying the show. What you said about it being lo-fi, I was thinking about that. There's a big fight scene in this most recent episode that's really brutal, and I was thinking how much more interesting that is than like, you know, world destroying sky beams and, you know, whole buildings falling over and like that kind of destruction we were getting a lot of in the MCU. It does feel so different for things to be a little bit more grounded and for people to still be superhuman and have superhuman abilities, but you can do that without it being like, well, I can punch through a planet, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's that great line Mike from Red Letter Media on YouTube says about big CGI fights. I think about the older I get, where he's like, I've seen so many movies now that whenever we get to the third act of a movie and all the CGI comes out and it's just a big CGI fight, like my eyes just kind of glaze over and I'm kind of just waiting for it to end. Obviously, I'm interested in what's happening on screen, but like, we're not kids. We know what we're seeing is kind of a fictional cinematic thing. But yeah, when you just get two guys doing a like just a fist fight in a room, somehow it feels more grounded. Like it feels more impactful. Also, God, I totally forgot. One battle after another. Hardly any CGI in that movie. Mostly just straight up in camera. It's really cool. Peacemaker, very similar. Like not a lot of CGI. It's pretty basic. Like they keep it pretty tight and manages to be really funny.
Yeah, I'm loving it. Looking forward to these next two episodes. What you wanted to finish out the segment with Gen V, which yeah. I've been watching. I don't think Zach has been. I've watched the first three episodes. I'm behind by one. I'm going to catch up tonight. The series is good. I just feel a little bit overwhelmed with TV between Alien Earth Peacemaker and now Gen V. And Gen V dropped three episodes and on their series premieres. It was just a lot to catch up with. The series, of course, is related to, it's an offshoot of The Boys. These two shows are actually starting to become more intertwined where we've seen people, Starlight, The Deep, some others show up from the main Boys series have shown up in this. We have a great cast of characters. I think it's a lot of, it's a really fun, group with, Jazz Sinclair who plays the main character, Marie Moreau, along with, Lizzie Broadway, and others that are just a whole lot of fun. Just really great group. I'm going to keep watching it. It does kind of just seem we're a little bit oversaturated with good TV, and also we might be a little superhero saturated too, because The Boys was supposed to be a very kind of subversive counterculture superhero or irreverent superhero series, and now it's kind of become what it was a caricature of. And we still have one more season of the Boys, which I think comes out next summer. So it's a lot, and then they're doing a prequel, but I'm enjoying the series.
Yeah, it's tough to keep up with for me because it's just an offshoot of a series that already I'm not watching actively. Like, I don't even think I caught the last season of The Boys. And I should have. Like, it's a great time. But yeah, this is a secondary show off that show. So I don't know how their numbers are doing, but I keep seeing memes about it. Like, people seem to enjoy it. It's funny. The Boys kind of embraces this idea of like what if superheroes were real and how that wouldn't actually be the good thing that everybody likes to imagine it would be. I've been rereading Watchmen, right? The old comic, or reading for the first time, actually. I tried to read it when I was younger and didn't really get it. And I've really been enjoying reading it. It's a really great read, way better than I thought it would be. And I should say I connect with it much more than I thought I would. It's as good as I thought it would be. Everybody says it's great, but I was reading Watchmen and Christine was sitting across from me on the couch reading her book. And she was like, hey, Watchmen is about like if superheroes were real, they'd be bad. Right. I was like, that's part of it. Yeah. And she was like The Boys. And I thought it was cool that like her immediate cultural like touchstone for this is something that Watchmen informed. Right. The Boys would not exist without Watchmen. And now she can look back and be like, oh yeah, it's like that Amazon show that you watched. It's like it and Stranger Things, art that informs art, bootstrapping itself, right? And The Boys is obviously part of that. Gen V is part of that too. I'm realizing now that I've told this story, this doesn't seem like a story that was worth telling, but whatever. It's a great time, I guess is what I'm saying. Would you or would you not recommend Gen V episodes 1 through 3?
I mean, definitely for fans of The Boys, it is a good series. And like I said, it's kind of this it's this teenage approach to superhero-ness. Like all our stars are in college. They're at a special college for superheroes. But it's also very Gen Z. Like their Instagram and social media have like a huge amount. Like they're all worried about their careers and that kind of. It does a good job of being like a teen, like a YA show. Almost it does still have like the bloodiness and goriness of The Boys, the irreverency, the like the sexual comedy, not quite to the degree of The Boys, but God, there's yeah, still dude. A lot of it in there. It's a real fun show.
Yeah. God, I forgot how sexual The Boys is in a negative way, like not in a positive way. Anyway, we got one more movie to talk about. This one's tough. This is a tough one to talk about. So I'm glad you let me take the summary on one battle because this one's a challenge for sure. I'll get out of your way though. Please, take it away.
This is the directorial debut of writer, director, actor, Ava Victor, who's done some TV, She was on the show Billions, I believe. And this is her debut. And this debuted at Sundance back in January, did some festivals, came out over the summer, heard a lot of buzz about it, heard a lot of people talking about it. Some people saying, like, this might be the best thing of the year, that kind of small indie buzz. So we finally got around to seeing it this week. Ava Victor plays Agnes, who, when we first meet her, she's meeting her friend, played by Naomi Ackie. They were in graduate school together. This is some years after that. They're meeting for, you know, she's visiting for the first time in a long time. They're catching up on life, and Naomi Ackie's character is having a baby, and Agnes is teaching at the college they both went to. But they allude to something that happened in the past, and Naomi Ackie is very much concerned for her friend and wants to make sure she's all right, make sure she's all right mentally. And then we get some backstory into what happened. Well, them and their group, their crew, was in graduate school. And it's a very heavy subject matter, but it's also, it's about trauma, like a lot of things are, but it's about what it's like to survive that and what it means for you to have to deal with that on a daily basis, where all your friends, like, the world moves on without you. It reminded me of Manchester by the Sea. It's a similar thing. In that case, it's a death in the family, and the world just kind of moves on, and you have to keep moving as well. But it's darkly funny. Like, this is, I don't think this is a spoiler, this movie's about sexual assault, and there's a lot of jokes in it, which, like, that might make people uncomfortable, but that's kind of our character, Agnes. It's like that. She's lovable. She's quirky. She's funny. Like, she's always cracking jokes. And even at the worst moments of her life, she's like, she's finding humor, and that's part of how she deals with it. But it's very complex, because it's about this terrible incident, how she's dealing with it, how it's affected her friends and her community, and how she has to just kind of keep going, and kind of act like this thing didn't happen, and find ways of coping and surviving. It's a very powerful movie, and it's small in scale. There's just a few actors in it. Zach, what do you think?
I think this is really tremendous work from Ava Victor, who I have not seen outside of this movie. Like, just watching it, I was thinking, who is this woman starring in the lead here? Because you'd think it'd be Naomi Ackie, right? We've seen her in a couple other features. Love Ackie. But Victor's the star here, and Naomi Ackie's supporting. And I was like, who is this woman? And then it's particularly surprising to see she also wrote and directed this movie. Oh, God. All right. Not only are you starring in your own feature and having to hold down this very deeply emotional and tender and often funny, but often, like, very, very tender. That's what I'm looking for, I guess. Performance, like, you're also, like, you wrote this script, and you have to get us from scene to scene and carry this emotion and carry the audience through it. There's something that's particularly challenging, and it's so tough, because Agnes is a character who is just stuck. And I think so much of Sorry Baby is about, like, point of view, right? Perception. Agnes does not necessarily feel like what exactly happened to her is what everybody says, and she doesn't, like, there's nuance to it. And the people she tells about this incident, they tell her, well, this is kind of what that sounds like. This sounds like it's, you know, it sounds like assault, Agnes. Like, this is bad. And she's like, you're right. But, like, I kind of don't feel that all the time. And as she kind of grows with it and learns more, like, her life just slows down, and the volume comes down for what's going on. She's a grad student, right? Like, things are exciting. She's a future ahead of her. And everything gets turned down from this thing, and she ends up just kind of trapped and stuck and stunted. And you get this wonderful foil of Aki's character, who's her friend, who is continuing to grow, right? She finds a partner, and they get together, and then they find a sperm donor, and they're going to have a baby. And, like, her life is continuing to roll down the hill, and Agnes is just kind of trapped in this horrible place. And, like, that creates a lot of space for humor, surprisingly, in ways that's really funny. Very funny. Very funny movie. But damn, it's a tough watch sometimes. Like, it hurts, man. Like, I feel so much for Ava Victor in this role, like, in this story.
It reminded me of Promising Young Woman and how much better this handles that subject matter, because it just feels so raw and so real. Like, you know, you see her go to this house at the of her graduate advisor in the daytime, and then it cuts to her leaving the house disheveled hours later, and that's all you need to know what happened. But also, it's so much more about her. It's about her as, again, she doesn't see herself as a victim. She's a survivor. And sometimes she forgets that the incident even happened. And then there's other parts where all these different things trigger her PTSD. And this is, one time I read something about, you know, trigger warnings are kind of useless because anything can be a trigger, and it can be as simple as a smell, a color, a place. It doesn't have to be something very explicit. And there's a lot of that in this movie. For instance, there's this thing about her taking off her boots, and she can't wear those boots ever again. Like, she puts them in a bag and throws them out. And there's different things that would just set off her memory and what happened. And but then there's also her working through it. It's a very kind of hopeful and uplifting movie dealing with a very, very dark subject matter in a very comedic way. Like, she's just cracking jokes throughout the whole thing while also
right.
reliving the horror, you know, like she does of this very, a couple of really moving monologues, but one where she kind of describes the incident as she remembers as it was happening when she's in this bathtub. And it's so matter of fact. She's not screaming. It's not like the Hollywood thing that you would often do. And this is one thing I say, I feel like a lot of people can't write conflicts for women. Besides sexual assault, it seems to be like the only thing that particularly men can think of to write. But it's an incredibly brave film and very moving and hopeful, and an incredible first film. And I remember I read that Barry Jenkins saw Ava Vector's like Instagram and they became friends at some point, and he was like, "Oh, you're a director." And before she had directed anything or written, and she'd only acted, and she was like, "Really? I don't see myself." Is that, and she was like, "Oh no, you need to be behind the camera," and that's part of what encouraged her to make this film.
Yeah. Additionally, she shadowed Jane Schoenbrunn on. I saw the TV Globe. She apparently was hanging out on set with Jane and being like, "How do you make a movie?" You know, and you see, I don't know if you see much of that influence visually on screen. It's a whole lot of tripod and a whole lot of lockdown shots, which is solid for a first feature. Like, you don't need any wild tricks. Like, you just need to get the basics down real good. And like, visually, that's what this movie accomplishes. Similarly, the soundtrack, like, very small, very, very minimal soundtrack. Like, it's a lot of long silence, you know, like just letting you sit with the weight of these kind of things. I feel so much for Agnes. Like, I just want to give her a big hug, you know? And like, that's part of the theme of the film. There's this great scene towards the end of the movie where she kind of explains the title. It feels cynical, and I wish it didn't feel like a cynical movie. And maybe that's just me bringing my own emotions to it. It, like, I feel like so much of the message is like, you know, there are good people out there who are there for you, but like, the world is hard and sucks and bad things are going to happen, and there's nothing anybody can do about that. Sorry, baby. And like, I wish I didn't feel that way. Like, damn, I wish this movie had something more hopeful to say to me. It doesn't in its sense of comedy, like in its sense of like giving you a laugh when things are tough. Like, maybe that's more the message. But it's heavy. It's heavy for sure. Like, it's funny. It's darkly funny, but it's also heavy. And I think that's important. Like, a content warning that should come with Sorry Baby, because I didn't know going in. I was like, I had loosely seen a trailer and then rented it on Prime to watch it for the show. That was as much as I knew getting into it. And it holds you at arm's length for the first act. It kind of gives you, it's told out of order, and it kind of gives you some space to be like, hey, something's up with Agnes, but I don't really know what. And you get down to it, and it's like, oh, baby, I wish it wasn't this way. So, yeah, it's like it's sentimental and sincere. That's the word I was looking for. Tender, sincere, really great first work from Ava Vector. Like, just fantastic.
Yeah, and her performance is so profound, because she doesn't do a lot of the cliche things that have become cliche in Hollywood when it comes to sexual assault. Like, she's not breaking down. She's not crying. She's not screaming. She's not throwing. Like, she kind of is actually the opposite. She becomes kind of in a trance. She's like stuck. She's kind of zombified. And again, this is part of the world moving on without her for several years while she's just sort of stuck in this stoic zone where she's just surviving, like, because she still has to keep living life, but she's also not advancing. So it's a very nuanced thing. Part of the humor I wanted to mention, there's a part where she's been interviewed by a doctor, and the doctor says something about, like, well, did your attacker do this? And she's like, well, I wouldn't say attacker. He didn't, like, wah! It wasn't quite like that. Like, she's, and it's like, and the whole movie is like that. You don't know if you're supposed to laugh or you can laugh or not, but that's, again, part of how she's dealing with, but it's also part of how she sees the whole incident. Like, it's a very nuanced discussion over the situation. There's a part where she feels, like, sympathetic to the assaulter for a number of reasons that are explained in this film. Like, it's not just black and white. So, very profound insight.
Yeah. Yeah, another great laugh in the movie. Real subtle. She's got these terrible memories associated with this one specific office space on campus. And then after she graduates, she ends up working part-time and then getting hired full-time at the university. And they give her the exact office. Like, she's got these memories of it's the same room and it's like the same furniture. And it's like, oh man, like, it's just heavy. It's heavy. And I don't know. That's Sorry, Baby. Andy, any other thoughts or recommendations?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Sorry, Baby?
Yeah, absolutely. Good. This is a big surprise. Like I said, I'd heard some a lot of buzz about it. It's funny. It's insightful. It's a great first film from writer director star Ava Victor. I'm anxious to see what she does next. Content warning. It does deal with some pretty heavy subject matter. But just be aware of that. But I would definitely recommend.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Big content warning. It's sexual assault. Talk of suicide. Like, big challenging themes in here. But, you know, also a very honest look at something that is so challenging that, like, does not have a binary black and white solution, right? Like, a shades of gray in spaces that film often doesn't travel to. Cannot wait to see what Ava Victor does next. She's tremendous. Act more, write more, direct more. Anywhere you want to go, I'm in. Like, this is a solid feature. Totally worth the watch. Worth mentioning, Victor tweeted just today, this is coming to HBO Max on October 30th. So if you don't want to rent it, if you don't want to spend the $6, which you should, we did, solid. Yeah, it'll be on there over there right at the end of October. So keep an eye out for Sorry, Baby. Good Lord, that's Off Script episode 309. Andy, what a week. What a week at the movies. What are we watching next week?
We're going to be taking a look at The Smashing Machine, which is the new indie film starring Dwayne Johnson as a legendary UFC fighter, Mark Kerr. This is it Benny Safdie or Joff Safdie? I can't remember
Benny.
The Safdie brothers.
I think Benny's doing it.
Thank you. Also starring Emily Blunt. A lot of buzz about this. The Rock's looking for an Oscar. We'll see if he earns it. And then maybe some TBD. There's a movie called Steve starring Cillian Murphy out on Netflix this week. I don't know at anything about it other than he is in it. Some other FYI releases. Good Boy, the horror movie starring a dog, is also out this week. And Bone Lake, another horror movie that we heard some buzz about as well. But next week, The Smashing Machine, possibly Steve, we'll let you know.
Yeah, I'm interested in Good Boy. And I'll tell you, it's not for the plot. It's because I think it's like 76 minutes. And I'm like, ooh, less than feature length. That's technically a short film, right? I don't know if we'll end up watching that for the show. Yeah, we're definitely gonna check out Smashing Machine. I think we're probably gonna go watch One Battle again. If you have the means, I know we mentioned it in the review, but if you have an IMAX near you or 70 millimeter, or God willing, you've got one of these three VistaVision screens. I think LA, New York, and like Massachusetts are the only three places that have one. Please go see it over there. It is the best way to see that movie. The bigger format, the better. XD or Dolby, if you got that, that's fine, but like totally worth checking out. If you enjoyed the show today, Off Script episode 309, or any of our previous episodes, best way to support us is just subscribe to the show on your favorite platform. Big things going on YouTube. You can come check us out over there. Throw a like on a rating and review if you can, or check out some of our older reviews. We got them clipped out. Spotify, iTunes, iHeart, Google Play for our audio listeners. Come check us out over there as well. Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, the usual social media places you can find us. Like, rate, review, and comment, of course. Our website is offscriptfilmreview.com. We're posting new stuff all the time. And you can email us correspondence directly, one-to-one, at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. Right into the mailbag. Tell us what you're watching, what you're thinking about. I don't know. Let us know what you thought of One Battle after another. And until next time, gosh, I think that's all of it. This is Off Script, episode 309, the home of Bold Cinema. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.